We're descending toward Hill Valley, California at 4:29 p.m. on Wednesday, October 21st, 2015.
2015? You mean we're in the future?
2015 sounded so far away, so much like the future, when Back to the Future Part 2 came out in 1989.
Hey, stop! Little girl, stop! Look, I need to borrow your
hoverboard.
Where is he?
Here. Something very familiar about all this.
Is there something familiar about the 2015 we're living in today? I'm Gina Kaufman. Today's Central Standard is all about the present, also known as the future of the recent past. We're living in the year Marty McFly visited back in 1989. Here to figure out what that means for reality is Chris McKitterick, director of the Gunn Center for the Study of Science Fiction at KU. Hi, Chris.
Morning.
We've also got Michael Rogers on the line. He's a practical futurist who once served as the futurist in residence at the New York Times. He's with us from Sicily. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
So, Michael, when was the last time you saw Back to the Future Part 2?
It was about 6 months ago. And I knew that 2015 was coming up. And of the two movies that really have influenced, I think, people's view of the future, one is Back to the Future, of course, which was set in 2015. And then we have Blade Runner coming up in 2019. So we may be having this conversation again, although, of course, Blade Runner was a little bit darker.
Yeah, well, and they both have some darkness in them in different ways. But let's talk about Back to the Future first. I do want to get back to Blade Runner. What stood out to you as a futurist when you watched Back to the Future Part 2 6 months ago?
Well, what struck me most was the longevity of the flying car idea. Futurists have been promising flying cars since at least the mid-50s, and they never happen.
Why do we want flying cars so bad?
You know, I think that it's a symbol of the future in the sense that it takes two of the most important inventions of the 20th century, aircraft and automobiles, and puts them together. The fact is, it's not a very practical idea for a whole lot of reasons. But it is one that obviously sticks in the mind.
Can you share some of the reasons that it's not a practical idea?
Sure. Some of them are just mechanical. Airplanes need lift. That's, you know, how they stay in the air. Cars shouldn't have lift because they're not supposed to rise up off the road. In fact, in very high-speed sports cars, you do a lot of aerodynamics to make sure that they don't take off. Secondly, and this is really where a lot of futurist predictions founder, there's just so many social and regulatory roadblocks to the flying car. Specifically, it's a whole new set of driving skills. Driving a car is really a 2D experience. Flying a plane is a 3D experience. So right away, the driver skills are much, much more complicated. Secondly, you're going to have to change fundamental infrastructure. Even if these flying cars take off and land in the same spot, you're going to have to make landing places. You're going to have to create new infrastructure besides roads. So right there, that's a problem. But the final problem that a lot of things run into is regulatory. Who is going to approve these things? It's probably going to be a combination of the Department of Transportation and the FAA and the Federal Aviation Agency. You know, they're having trouble approving drones at this point. Can you imagine how long it will take them to approve a flying car?
All right. So you heard it here. Flying cars not coming anytime soon. Chris, what about you? When did you last see Back to the Future Part 2?
Oh, boy. It's got to have been about 10 years now, I think.
So how well do you remember this movie?
Well, you know, one of the things that everybody remembers is the hoverboards, right? And, of course, traveling to the future, far into the future, in 2015. But one thing I thought about it recently was that there was a Kickstarter, just a few months ago. A company is starting up a hoverboard company. They're actually producing hoverboards. If you look closely at the technology, though, what they're producing is something that works in a park that's set up in order to be able to operate using magnetic support and everything. So it's very cool, but you couldn't actually take it anywhere outside of the hoverboard park.
So hovering, it's so funny to me that people want to hover. It does not sound like an exciting verb. Do you think that with some rebranding, it could sound more exciting? I mean, it looks really fun, but when you're like, I want to hover, that just, I mean, can we work on this a little bit? Chris, it seems like you're kind of a language guy. What do you have?
Oh, I'm not a marketing guy, though, so I'm not sure. You'd want to have something about how it's exciting, about, you know, how you're able to be free and fly. And I'd probably use some sort of bird imagery in the name.
What do you think, Michael, about hoverboards?
Well, you know, hoverboards, two quick thoughts. One is the technology. I really watched the hoverboard when I saw the movie the last time. And the only way I can think of it really working is with anti-gravity, which is a problem because in 2015, we're not even going to have a coherent theory of gravity.
Wait, we don't have a coherent theory of gravity?
Not fully, no. It's one of the, you know, still complex bits of physics that has not been. We know what gravity does, but we don't fully understand how it works. So anti-gravity would be an incredible breakthrough. In fact, I think, you know, probably the two breakthroughs that are most important in the movie, one is time travel, which, you know, may or may not be possible, and anti-gravity, which may or may not be possible. But from what we know of current physics, both of those are far in the distance, if they happen at all.
A lot of the predictions in Back to the Future have to do with things that would be kind of fun or just sort of surprising and inconvenient for someone who's transported without any transitions to this place. So that doesn't necessarily match what is practical and needed in technology. So, like, hovering on a hoverboard would be fun, but there's no, like, great pressing need for it. But there is an unmanned gas station in Back to the Future Part 2, which I looked terrifying, you know, that it had its own, like, tentacle-like gas pumps. But can we talk about things that a lot of technology has become unmanned? Chris?
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the things that kind of creeps me out, but it's also really awesome and will probably lead to a lot fewer accidents, are self-driving cars. And not only something really dramatic like the Google car that drives all by itself, but things like the new Lexus that can park itself. All you have to do is pull into a spot you want to, or park next to a spot you want to park in. You just press a button and it parks it for you. But then these days, most cars, in fact, are driven completely through electronics that you're just giving some input into the computer to say, let's turn left, let's stop, let's accelerate.
What about,
you know?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, let me just add to that. I've actually ridden in the Google car. It's very impressive. When I was riding in it, though, I was in the passenger seat.
Can you tell us more about the Google car, first of all, in case people aren't familiar?
The Google car is a completely self-driving car, and it uses a complicated set of sensors that include sort of laser-powered radar, a lot of computing power. It refers to Google Maps in terms of navigation, but when I rode in it, it actually could navigate suburban streets. It stopped at four-way stop signs. It waited for other cars to go in front. It actually accelerated nicely onto 101 North going towards San Francisco. Now, the important bit that I should mention here is that when I was being shown it, there were also two MIT PhDs in the car, one behind the steering wheel to grab it in case something went wrong, and the other one in the back seat with a laptop, sort of monitoring everything that the car did, all the computers. So I'm not sure what the economics are of a car that comes equipped with two MIT PhDs.
Well, so that's an interesting thing, because with the idea of so much becoming unmanned, there's a lot of excitement around that. But then there's the question of, when it malfunctions, are we as humans powerless? And maybe that gets us a little closer to Blade Runner territory, but Michael, can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. And that is one of the concerns with self-driving cars, is that the driver becomes totally detached from what's going on, and suddenly, you know, there's an emergency and they're really not paying attention. Interestingly, when we go to the self-driving car, I think what we're going to see first, and this is actually well along in the development phase, is networked cars, cars that can talk to each other. And will actually use a modified form of Wi-Fi to communicate with each other. Probably by the end of this decade, cars will begin to come with this. And ultimately, it'll be as standard an item as seatbelts. And what that lets the cars do, in a sense, is protect the humans from each other. Literally, one car could say to the one next to it, "You're not going to believe this, but the driver of my car seems to be getting ready to turn right in front of you, so you better slow down."
The road, it sounds like there's some argument that humans are so fallible as drivers that technology might be better suited to navigating the roads in communication with other technology. But I do feel like we are maybe getting into Blade Runner territory, where the cars become much like the robots that created for the good of humanity. But, I mean, there could be a dark side. Could there not, Michael Rogers?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and in an odd way, you know, what a classic science fiction notion is that the robots become our masters, that we have robot overlords. And it's been done in, as Chris undoubtedly knows, you know, dozens of different formats, this notion of the machines taking over. You know, in some ways, I think that's already happening. I mean, the machines are really training us how to talk to them, how they understand us, what they need. We take such good care of them now. In an odd way, the computers are really shaping who we are as people. And at some point, the question's going to arise, you know, are we shaping computers or have they started to shape us?
Chris McKitterick, I'd love to get you in on this. How has this scenario played out in the decades of science fiction you've studied?
The idea of artificial intelligence and intelligent robots and so forth.
Yeah.
Well, there's been a whole bunch of different notions about how that would work out. In the very early days of science fiction, in fact, when it was first being called science fiction after magazines started coming out. But Jack Williamson wrote about a type of robot called humanoid, and their job is to serve and protect man from harm. Now, that's a pretty general set of rules, and if computers operate on rules, just as we do, although we have much more fuzzy logic, obviously, but an artificial intelligence who is told to protect people could very easily start stripping away different freedoms that we have to prevent us from doing harm to ourselves or others. So the scenario where you have a self-driving car, it's fantastic. They can send messages to each other. They can prevent each other from crashing, from humans from doing stupid things. But on the other hand, they're also going to be fallible in a lot of ways. You can ask yourself, what would be the safest thing to do would be to leave the car in the garage. So if we have a really protective computer, it would say, oh, it's raining out. You don't want to drive today. And it just wouldn't go. That would be an exciting thing. But I think the thing that's more interesting and more scary as a science fiction writer is something that Frederick Pohl, longtime science fiction writer, just died last year, a longtime friend of the Center for the Study of Science Fiction, Grandmaster, did a talk here in the 70s, and he described what science fiction does, that basically it shows the possible side effects, the unintended consequences, things he said, second and third order derivatives. And an example that he used was talking about, say, there's this guy a couple thousand years ago talking about nice ways to treat each other and ways to make society work better. It'd be Jesus. And a lot of people could foresee things like the church occurring. They could even foresee people being persecuted for believing in this heretic. However, what science fiction does is says, okay, so what kinds of things could go wrong? So something like the Crusades or the Spanish Inquisition, or my favorite example that he used is Thursday night bingo at the church. So what could go wrong with self-driving cars? The thing that I'm most concerned about is somebody, I mean, there are hackers out there. You have a self-driving car, it needs to be networked. And as we all learned from Battlestar Galactica, networked computers are dangerous once you start getting people with bad notions in mind involved.
Well, that is fascinating. I do want to get us back to a couple of other things in Back to the Future Part 2, and we'll branch out a little bit more shortly. But something, there were things, sort of frivolous things like self-lacing shoes that, I mean, I guess no one's terribly inconvenienced by tying their own shoes. But there's also this, there's a wall-mounted television screen, which isn't really how televisions were in the 80s. And when the phone rings and it's answered, the person appears on the screen, but so does a lot of personal information. That person's name appears on the television screen, who he's married to, what his address is. And this is actually not far from how telecommunications works now, that whatever format we're using to communicate, a lot of information accompanies just the act of reaching out. And that there's a relationship between the television and the phone, only I think they might have gotten it reversed. Michael, can you address that?
Oh, yeah. I thought that, interestingly, that was one of the things that they pretty much nailed, along with a couple other information technology pieces. In fact, just parenthetically, it's kind of interesting that the writers really did foresee the shape of the television and the Skype and the way we were going with video calling. Yet there were still fax machines in the film. So it's funny, you know, the fax machine was actually a fairly important piece of technology in the film. Yet, of course, it doesn't make any sense now. So absolutely, I think that, already that kind of information about the person who's calling, and that's already in customer call centers. When you call, say, a credit card company, you know, it probably will recognize your phone number, and even before you have said a word, will bring up a complete dossier about who you are, what products to sell you, what you might be interested in,
and speaking
for the
of unintended
operator to look at.
Unintended consequences, no more prank calling. That's ruined.
Right. Maybe we won't miss that.
What is the so you just mentioned that they got it right on some level, including the design of the television screen and how that was going to change. What is the relationship between the imagined futures of science fiction and the innovations that actually come about? Does science fiction inform how we imagine and invent new devices and infrastructure, Chris?
Well, you know, I think the best way to answer that is to Isaac Asimov, one of the greats in science fiction, in the golden age of science fiction, talked about how, back in the 60s, he said that we're living in a science fiction world. That is to say that that science fiction didn't create the world that we are on. The science fiction did not land a man on the moon later in that decade. But what science fiction did was help create a climate where the public would accept the notion of going to the moon. And then you have countless scientists and engineers who reflect back on science fiction that inspired them to do something, like Leo Szilard, right? Back in 1914 was a novel by H.G. Wells called The World Set Free. And that's when this Manhattan Project founder started thinking about atomic energy and atomic bombs. Unintended consequence was the Cold War, of course, and dropping bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. On the other hand, this is something that science fiction got people thinking about. So I would say the closest relationship between technological advances in science and science fiction is sort of getting people to think about these ideas.
What did you think 2015 would look like? Call us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. We'll be chatting with you in a minute. Don't go away. And we're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to Central Standard. Call 816-235-2888 to join this conversation about how 2015 is shaping up in comparison with our predictions. This is the year Marty McFly visited in Back to the Future 2, but predictions for the future are everywhere in movies, books, even politics. What did you think 2015 would look like, and are you pleased or disappointed by the differences? 816-235-2888. 2888. When you call, you'll be talking with Chris McKitterick of the Gunn Center for the Study of Science Fiction at KU and practical futurist Michael Rogers with us from Sicily. Hi again, Chris.
Morning.
And greetings, Michael.
Thank you very much.
So Chris was just giving his perspective on the difference between in science fiction when we imagine things, and is that just another way of saying we're beginning to invent it? I wonder if you can give some of your perspective on that.
Well, I think that Chris made a good point with, and a follow up on the fact that many of the scientists and engineers that I talked to grew up on science fiction. And I think it created maybe not so much a specific notion about what they wanted to build, but the fact that they could make a different future. I'm kind of an example. I was a computer electronics kid. I was a nerd actually before we were called nerds.
what were you called then?
The unpopular kids. I can remember being really disappointed maybe at age 5 or so when I discovered that we had not yet landed on the moon. Because I'd been watching science fiction on television, and it looked to me like we were already on the moon. So I wasn't disillusioned by hearing there wasn't a Santa Claus. I was disillusioned by the fact that we hadn't landed on the moon yet. And, you know, I think my reading of science fiction has always led me to want to invent the next thing. When I went into the media world, that was I liked the media world, I liked writing, and I liked the work I was doing, but I really wanted to design what was going to come next. So I think that consuming science fiction at an early age does create a desire in at least some people to create a future of their own.
Michael, can you explain to us what it means to be a futurist?
Yes, it's kind of a fuzzy designation.
It used to be an art movement.
Exactly so, here in Italy, as a matter of fact. And it was about the future, even back then, but it was more of a passionate fascination with speed and machinery. Interestingly, here in Europe, they still don't say futurist as much as they say foresight analyst. And even futurists in the United States, more serious ones, I think, shy away from the term futurist, partly because futurists are just mostly known for those flying car predictions. But for me, I'm an accidental futurist in many ways, because my background was both technology and writing. I started out writing science fiction years ago. I ended up doing a lot of this new media work for Newsweek and the Washington Post and the New York Times, and just got more and more interested in why some things happened successfully and why some things didn't. So that was how I became a futurist, was really by trying to make the future happen and sort of seeing what worked and what didn't.
So the future, in terms of the passage of time, happens no matter what. Short of an apocalypse, it happens no matter what. And so what do you mean when you say trying to make the future happen?
Well, I think, for example, making a specific kind of future happen. My interest, if you'd asked me what surprises me most about 2015, if you'd asked me 15 years ago, I would have said that newspapers and magazines would be doing very, very well in terms of their online businesses. But in fact, they're pretty much struggling in terms of adapting to the online world. So my desire to see newspapers and magazines thrive in the digital world, I put a lot of work into that. But larger forces were at work, and now it's a much tougher business model for newspapers and magazines than I think almost anyone would have guessed back at the turn of the century.
What were some of your other predictions for 2015, closer to the turn of the century?
I was completely convinced that the television, the telephone, and the computer were going to merge into a single device. Because even back then, you could see that all communications was going to be digital. And at some point, when everything is digital, it becomes sort of trivial as to what it shows up on. It's all going to be on a screen. It's going to come through a speaker. Doesn't particularly make any difference whether that's a television or a computer or a phone. It's interesting. I think in terms of information technology, both communications and computers, it's been a little easier to make predictions simply because we have things like Moore's Law, which is the now 30 or 40-year-old law that says the number of transistors on a chip, which determines either the processing power or the memory, that just about doubles every 18 to 24 months. So,
and that hasn't changed?
That has not really changed since the 60s. Right now, it looks like it will continue to be true out until the early 20s. So that just means that simply mathematically, the iPhone of 2020 will be about as powerful as a large size business server is today. So that's incredibly powerful, and that's simply going to happen. Those chips, in many cases, are being developed now.
We have talked a lot about what we don't have, but let's talk about what we do have, because I feel like if someone from the 1980s fell asleep and Rip Van Winkle style just woke up in 2015, communications technology and our relationship with it would probably, from my perspective, be the most comprehensive and surprising change. Michael Rogers, do you see it that way?
Absolutely. I mean, if you gave, I think, even a technically sophisticated person back in the mid-80s, the cell phone of today, the smartphone of today, they'd be utterly baffled. Once they figured it out, like most two-year-olds can today, they'd be fascinated. But it would truly seem like something from the future. And I don't think anyone really understood back then how powerful the smartphone would be.
Chris McKitterick, I'm going to acknowledge I'm not well-versed in Star Trek, but I am told that Star Trek actually predicted some of the communications technology that we use today. What other science fiction might have predicted some of this in ways that we lay people might not have noticed?
Oh, boy. You know, if you go back to Buck Rogers, I mean, this is back in the early pulp era in the early part of the 20th century. We had Buck Rogers communicating with a wristwatch or with a little portable device. And so much of what Star Trek was doing was sort of lifting that early pulp, especially the space opera kind of pulp, and updating it and making it more realistic based on the people's time then, the sort of technologies that they were familiar with. And that communicator badge that people used, or the flip phone, basically, that they used in Star Trek, this is the reason the early portable cell phones that you actually could put in your pocket were phones that were flip phones, is that the designer acknowledged that he was inspired by Star Trek design. Oh, and I was just going to say the other things in Star Trek that were not so accurate, like the teleporter, for instance. The reason that they used the teleporter is that it was a budgeting reason. It would be too expensive to land a spaceship in every episode and take off, and it would waste a lot of time.
So teleporting was practical.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think it would be very practical myself.
Right. Mm-hmm. We have teleportation right now, but only of very small information about particles. And some people argue whether or not that's really teleportation that's going on there. But as far as information technology goes, I mean, science fiction isn't really about prediction. I mean, back to what Fred Pohl said is that it's inherently unpredictable to try and predict, what goes on in the future.
Do you think that 3D printing could be seen as a form of teleportation?
An interesting thing just happened that NASA emailed a wrench up to the space station. They didn't have a wrench up there. Something broke. They had to fix it. And they had a 3D printer on board. Very foresightful to have that. And were able to create a tool that they needed. Now, science fiction, especially since we started seeing things like nanotech and where 3D prints down to the molecular level, that's where 3D printing is going to become really important in our daily lives, is when we can print out, say, food. This is something people are working on right now. Shovel in some dirt and out comes whatever you want, organized in a palatable way.
So weird. Michael Rogers, what do you know about what they're doing with this right now? What the real life translation of teleportation might be?
You know, I think 3D printing is a pretty good example of it at this point. The teleportation, as Chris says, is mostly a theoretical concept right now. But when you think about 3D printing and how it could be sort of practically used, one example I like to give is, let's say you are a large German plumbing goods manufacturer who sells a lot in the United States. These days, you have to have a big warehouse, probably somewhere in New Jersey, that stocks all the parts for all of your appliances and plumbing goods. If someone in the United States needs one, then you can send them this replacement part. At some point, it will be cheaper to have 3D printers that can print plastic and metal and rubber and all the parts that go in appliances. And print them on demand in New Jersey. That'll be an expensive piece of technology, very expensive, but it may well be, in the long run, cheaper than shipping all this stuff from Frankfurt and storing it in New Jersey for 10 years.
And more energy efficient, quite possibly. And one thing we haven't really talked about is that there are social issues in science fiction, that we don't just imagine a technological future, but we also imagine a social future and a human future. What about the warnings in that respect of science fiction? Are the people who are inventing things today raised on those warnings in equal part with those aspirations, Michael?
You know, I think at the early excitement of invention, it's very easy to not think about those warnings. But then it's quite interesting. One of the classic examples is a fellow who was named Bill Joy, who was one of the founders of an early microcomputer company called Sun Microsystems that was huge and very successful and influenced a great deal of Silicon Valley. Once he was quite successful at what he was doing, he began to write, you know, quite dubious things about the future of technology and those sort of human downsides. But I find that younger technologists who are just beginning to do their work tend to downplay the negative parts. It's only as we get a little older and wiser that we see, uh-oh, there may be, as we said earlier, unintended consequences here.
Chris McHitterick, are there warnings that you think that we should be heeding in this moment in 2015 from the science fiction of the past that is slowly in some ways becoming our reality?
Oh, absolutely. This is why so much of the science fiction that makes it into the movies is about things that go wrong. And things that we can actually change are the social things. Now, invention is still going to be moving along at the rate at which people want new things and new exciting new things. But ever since, oh gosh, let's see, Arthur Clarke wrote a story back in 1964 called Dial F for Frankenstein. And what he was doing there was suggesting that network computers could learn to think autonomously. And then, well, you know, now we have Frankenstein's creature. But other types of things, social predictions, something like Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, I think is a really interesting series of predictions about what could happen if we have an extremist religious organization taking over the U.S. government, and how would that change if we have a military theocracy. So things like that, science fiction takes a look at in many ways. For example, like the environmentalist movement back in the 70s and 60s, so very much fertilized by science fiction stories that were set on a ruined Earth. And like the Cold War, it's a very interesting story. I don't know if you went and saw when The Day After had its 25th anniversary showing in Liberty Hall here in Lawrence, Kansas. But the director was talking about how, after having sent this to President Reagan, he was so moved by it, by the possible human effects of a nuclear war, because the nuclear war itself is just a very brief effect at the beginning of the movie. But then after this, we see the slow and horrible effects of what a nuclear war could do to people, just regular, average, everyday American citizens in the Midwest, in Lawrence, in fact. And he was so moved by this that he sent it to his counterpart in the Soviet Union, And this is part of what kickstarted their dearmament talks, which is pretty astounding to think about.
It's interesting that we've come to politics because The Atlantic recently ran an article about what U.S. intelligence predicted 2015 would look like in an 85-page report that came out just months before the September 11th attacks. The report includes financial volatility, cyber attacks, decreasing U.S. control over the global flow of information, things that have happened, but also a Palestinian state and an African continent unaffected by advances in telecommunications. How do intelligence communities predict the future differently from, say, writers and filmmakers? Michael?
I think that the intelligence communities need to do things that are a little more statistical, that appear to have less of sort of a creative spark to them than, you know, some kind of real means of determining what is a likely scenario. One of the most famous futurist techniques is creating scenarios of then, you know, maybe three or four different potential scenarios for 2015 and, say, energy consumption. And then breaking those down into individual pieces and see which each assumption within the scenario is, assigning a likelihood to that, and then ultimately choosing one scenario as the best scenario on the basis of this sort of this mathematical reckoning. I think that that's a little dubious because sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And as we've said, the future itself is almost always a surprise.
It's always a surprise, but we invest so much energy in trying to predict it. Everyone does, whether we're talking about tomorrow or two decades from now or a century from now.
Well, what I like to do sometimes is quote one of the early American futurists who said, "The future will always surprise us, but we shouldn't let it dumbfound us." And I think that's probably, you know, what I try to bring to my clients and audiences is this sense of this is approximately what the future is going to be like. We can be certain that there will be, for example, much more social networking, that there'll be much more data about us and about what we do that shapes all of the objects around us. We don't know exactly what form that will take, but that kind of sort of general observation can shape what one does today.
Why do some predictions come true while others are completely off, not just in the arts, but in U.S. intelligence predictions?
Go ahead, Chris.
Oh, I was just going to say something that John W. Campbell, this is the editor of science fiction magazine that had probably the greatest effect in the 30s and 40s and 50s. And he said that science fiction is just dreams written out. It consists of the hopes and fears and dreams, because some dreams are nightmares of a technologically based society. So what science fiction does that perhaps military predictions don't do is it says, here are the things that we hope the future will look like, hoverboards, flying cars. Here are the things that we dream about in going to different stars or teleporting ourselves through 3D printers that can print ourselves into a body we can apply our brains to. But also fears and nightmares. When we had the Cold War going on, we saw so much science fiction about possible world war. When the 80s started to show that corporations were getting more and more powerful, we saw the rise of cyberpunk, saying that corporations started just sort of jumping over the middleman, that is government, and ruling the world. So what science fiction is looking at is specifically that, and that is what people most want and fear and are concerned about, because we're going to be living in the future unless we die right now.
Michael, what's your answer to this? Why do some predictions come true while others are just off base completely?
Often it is social and human factors that the futurist does not take into account. Futurists always start, I think, with technology and or almost always, and work out from there, and sort of don't see, you know, the stumbling blocks that are in the way.
People.
Okay. People. Regulations. It's interesting. We can. Here's a fairly recent example. Is the Segway, you know, the little, it's pretty close to a hovercraft in some ways. It's
except that it's device. On the ground.
It's on the ground, but it you know, if you blur your eyes, you might think it's kind of a hovercraft, and indeed it navigates the way that that Marty's hoverboard worked. You lean in one direction, lean in another. Before the Segway was actually launched, you know, Steve Jobs said he felt it might be the most important invention since the PC. Various venture capitalists talked about just how it was going to revolutionize transportation. Well, it turned out that, A, people didn't really feel the need to travel at the speed that a Segway does down the sidewalk. Number two, most municipalities didn't want Segways on the sidewalk, and they couldn't really go in the road either. So, you know, now 12 years later, Segways are primarily used by mall policemen and tourists.
Well, so, let's come right back to that after the break. I'm Gina Kaufman. You're listening to Central Standard. We'll be back shortly. You can still get on this conversation, 816-235-2888. Don't go away. It's 2015. I still find that unbelievable. I thought it was going to be sort of mirrored and metallic with hard surfaces everywhere, and I'm glad that that's not how it is. I'm joined by Chris McKitterick of the Gunn Center for the Study of Science Fiction at KU and practical futurist Michael Rogers. They both have much more in-depth and scientific kinds of predictions than it's just going to be mirrored and metallic. So we'll get back to them. Guys, the future has always been catching up with humanity. Have there been other moments other than 2015 when people were really interested in comparing the predictions with reality? Because 2015 seems to have a lot of people doing this. Michael?
Oh, I think the year 2000 was a big one. And I think 1984, for those in the audience who can remember 1984, was also a big one.
What were the conversations like?
Well, back in 1984... it's interesting. People said that George Orwell's predictions of, you know, the society that is all controlling, the government that's all controlling and knows everything that you do, you know, people tended to sort of look at their televisions and go, well, this is controlling my mind in a way, but it's really not as bad as what Orwell predicted. So I think in 1984, people, you know, would write essays sort of explaining how, well, it wasn't exactly like 1984, but we were heading in a direction where a 1984 scenario might come to pass. Interestingly enough, we are now probably much closer to the world of 1984 in terms of what the government and big corporations know about us than we were in 1984. That's one example.
Yeah, Chris, what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, 1984 also, Aldous Huxley had predicted things like antidepressants, that we'd be living on medical technology that allowed us to feel happier or feel more comfortable in our lives. And there's something that if you can say 1984 averted a world like 1980, like Orwell described in the book, something like Brave New World actually gave us some suggestions for things that maybe wouldn't be so bad. I'm interested to think that people didn't think Soma would be creepy because happiness, you know, people choose happiness over a lot of other things. But what science fiction writer Theodore Sturgeon, and we have an award we give named after him, what we called Sturgeon's Law is ask the next question. And he talks about whatever it is that you perceive going on in the world, what's the next thing to happen? And then what's the thing after that? Keep asking questions about what follows. To, you know, what Fred Pohl was talking about with the second and third level derivatives. Don't stop with, oh, cool, we're going to have, you know, segues. That means we're going to be able to get around quickly and easily. Well, what could go wrong with that?
Is that
sort of social repercussions?
Is that something we should ask ourselves as adopters of technologies? Yes, but even new trends, new ideas, what happens next? Because I feel like there is that sort of excitement over something new without thinking through consequences.
Oh, boy. You know, my first novel, Transcendence, I had been a little bit concerned about what the internet was going to mean for people actually interacting with other people. And I thought, oh, that's a very simple prediction, that we're going to see each other less. But what happens when we actually see other human beings less? If we add into that, say, annotated reality and reality shows, and never actually having to perceive another human being as a human being, because what you're looking at isn't necessarily exactly who they are, it's easy to start thinking less of them as being a human being with thoughts and feelings and their own drives. And it's easy to start being, you know, looking at the world in a selfish way. And that was what spurred that book. So that's kind of the way that science fiction writers approach something, is they see a cool thing and say, okay, so what could go wrong with that? Not just the good things.
So another way of interpreting what comes next, what's the next thing that follows, is to say, okay, if we want these cool things, we probably need other things to make them possible. Like a thing that's come up a lot is infrastructure, needing infrastructure for, say, flying cars, which I acknowledge have been proven earlier in the show unlikely. Michael?
We have two of them right now, you know, by the way, just not practical.
Well, talk about
anyway.
That. Talk about that.
Oh, well, there's this guy, Moeller, has a Moeller air car, which was originally designed to be something that you and I could just drive to work, because it would fly by itself and land by itself. All we had to do was sort of basically use GPS and say, I want to go here. And the FAA said, not so much. You need to be a pilot in case the computer goes wrong. Completely defeating the notion of this air car. But you can buy one if you're wealthy and you have a pilot's license. And there's another flying car out there by Terra Fuga, the transition rotable aircraft. And this is something that people have been actually selling since the 50s. It was really a big thing in the 50s to have cars that you could then add wings to once you drive to an airport and fly away.
And Michael, what are your thoughts about this issue of infrastructure being sort of the thing that we failed to think about when we were getting really excited?
I'll give you a very present-day example, is the excitement over electric cars and the ability to drive your electric car home and charge it at night. The utility companies in the United States actually are pretty glad that that has not caught on, because the existing utility grid we have in many cities, if you had, say, seven or eight people on the same block, all with electric cars that they plugged in to charge at the same time at night, it would pretty much blow out the power lines. The grid itself is not sophisticated enough to support a large number of electric cars. So, of course, the utility companies are scrambling now to upgrade the utility grids, because sooner or later, probably the early 20s, my prediction is plug-in hybrid cars will be becoming much more of a standard. So there's one example right there.
But it sounds like the future takes longer because of infrastructure. It doesn't prevent it from happening.
Correct.
Let's talk to Calvin in Overland Park. Hi, Calvin.
Yeah, hey, Gina. Something you said a few minutes ago about expecting 2015 to be more shiny metallic caught my attention. My wife and daughter just got back from Disney World, and we visited Tomorrowland, which I think was built back in the 60s or 70s, and that kind of fit that perception. And then they also have a Future World at Epcot, which is a bit more contemporary and deals with more things like the environment and stewardship of the planet. But it's interesting now. I mean, if Tomorrowland was built today, I think it would be a much more dystopian than utopian, just based on current attitudes. Just thought that was really interesting, having just been there.
Yeah, the
idea. Thanks.
Thank you. And the idea of amusement parks being sort of their own kinds of visions of the future. Michael, what can you tell us about that?
Well, it's interesting. It reminds me of Microsoft. Their campus in Redmond, they have a home of the future that they sort of upgrade every once in a while. And there was talk briefly that they were going to do a deal with Disney to actually do a home of the future at one of the Disney worlds. But in a sense, it's for the customers and clients of Microsoft. And when you visit, it's like a little amusement park. It's a whole house that you go through, and it's got all of these sort of amazing techno gadgets. I remember one example that I saw was all of the refrigerator is capable of knowing exactly what food is in the refrigerator at any given time. And so it tells you what to order to make sure that there's plenty of food in the refrigerator. But then if you're interested in cooking something, you take out four or five ingredients and you set them on a counter, and a camera up in the ceiling, looks at them, does some quick computations, and comes up with a recipe to use exactly those ingredients, which it then projects in bright light on the top of the counter, so you can follow the recipe with the ingredients. So it was a little like an amusement park ride with all these amazing gadgets and devices. So, you know, I think a number of companies now have things like the home of the future.
Well,
sort of a
Oh, I'm so sorry to have to jump in, but we're out of time. Chris McKitterick of the Gunn Center for the Study of Science Fiction, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Gina.
And Michael Rogers, author and former New York Times futurist in residence, thanks so much. It's been an honor.
My pleasure. Thank you.
To listen back to today's show or to any conversations you've heard on Central Standard, go to kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, speaking of the future, what's the future of farming in western Kansas and what does water have to do with it? I'm Gina Kaufman. That's it for today. The show is produced by Sylvia Maria Gross and Matthew Long Middleton.